in Vilnius, Lithuania. Natalia Satsunkevich is with the Belarusian human rights group Vyazna. Part two will be at democracynow.org. We dedicate today's show to our colleague, Brent Renaud, and to all those who've died during this invasion. He went to Ukraine to document the refugees from Ukraine and global refugees around the world. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Accepting job applications for human resources manager. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeit-Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Amin Sheikh, Maria Tersena, Tamri Warnoff, Camille Baker, Sam Alkoff, Tamria Studio. Special thanks to John Alpert and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th annual Sing Time Weekend Retreat of Portland Folk Music Society. From 6 p.m. March 25th until noon on March 27th, at the Minucha Conference Center in Corbett. Sing Time features workshops, song circles, concerts, and lots of singing and jamming in a residential setting. A scholarship fund is available, and vaccinations and masks are required. Again, that's Portland Folk Music Society's Sing Time Weekend Retreat, starting at 6 p.m. on Friday, March 25th, at the Minucha Conference Center, 38711 E Historic Columbia River Highway in Corbett. More information can be found at portlandfolkmusic.org/singtime.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's pandemic-era outdoor dining program will continue through the end of August. Average U.S. gas prices have risen 22% in just the past 2 weeks, and Russia continues to pound Ukraine as diplomatic negotiations fail to make concrete progress. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 14th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The City of Portland said Monday that it will continue waiving fees for business owners who participate in its Healthy Business Permits program through the summer. The program allowed more than 1,000 struggling restaurants and businesses to expand onto sidewalks and street parking, as indoor dining was limited due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The program was set to expire on June 30th, but now has been extended through August 31st. Portland Commissioner Joanne Hardisi said her hope is for the city to establish a new permanent program. However, she said to make the program permanent, the permits will no longer be free and will need to include a fee to be sustainable. A permanent program would also need to be approved by the Portland City Council. Many restaurant owners have said the program has been a lifeline for establishments struggling to stay open during the pandemic. At Monday's press conference, city leaders also spoke about another pandemic-era program, Portland Public Street Plazas. Under the program, the Portland Bureau of Transportation has partnered with community organizations to turn city streets into safe outdoor gathering spaces for artists, family activities, community events, and public seating. Hardisi says she's directing PBOT to start a transition to make that program permanent as well. Oregon reported far fewer coronavirus cases in the week ending Sunday, down 40% from the previous week's tally. Across Oregon, cases fell in 32 of 36 counties, with the most steep declines in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. More than 699,000 people in Oregon have tested positive for the coronavirus since the pandemic began. At least 6,869 people have died in Oregon from the disease. The Oregon Health Authority said in a news release that the state's pandemic management has been highly successful. Oregon now ranks second lowest in the U.S. for COVID cases per 100,000 people and seventh lowest in terms of deaths. Oregon, Washington, and California lifted their mask mandates for indoor public spaces and schools over the weekend, but masks must still be worn on public transit and in healthcare facilities. Under the latest guidance, businesses, individual school districts, local governments, and public health authorities can decide whether to enforce their own masking requirements. Former President Barack Obama said on Sunday that he had tested positive for COVID-19, though he is feeling relatively healthy. Michelle Obama was also tested and found to be negative. Obama tweeted, quote, "I've had a scratchy throat for a couple days, but I'm feeling fine otherwise. Michelle and I are grateful to be vaccinated and boosted." The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that 75% of U.S. adults are fully vaccinated, and 47% of the fully vaccinated have received a booster shot. Oregon lawmakers have passed greater protections for election workers who have faced threats and harassment since the 2020 election. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
In response to an uptick in threats against election workers after the 2020 election, Oregon lawmakers passed a measure this session that gives them greater protections. House Bill 4144 increases the penalties for harassing election workers and shields their personal information. Chris Walker is Jackson County Clerk, in charge of elections for the county. She says elections always are tense, especially presidential elections, since roughly half the population is going to be disappointed.
What we have not experienced, as we have since the 2020 election, is the amount of anger directed toward elections officials themselves. And that was kind of new territory for us.
Walker has witnessed threats herself. In the weeks after the 2020 election, graffiti that said "Vote, don't work," and "Next time, bullets" were found painted on the parking lot near her election office in Medford. Under the measure, the maximum penalty for harassing an election worker is punishable by 364 days in prison and a $6,250 fine. The bill comes at the request of Secretary of State Shamia Fagan. In a survey of Oregon Elections Division workers in her office, Fagan found 10 of the 13 people who responded had experienced threats or harassment. Ben Morris, Communications Director for the Secretary of State's office, says this measure will bolster what are already well-run elections.
It sends a really clear message to people who may seek to try to interfere that threats and harassment targeting election workers are going to be met with penalties, but those actions will not change the outcome of the election.
Walker says people have been reacting with anger to misinformation, especially on social media. She wants people to think of their county clerk as a source of accurate information, and she adds that election workers are going to continue doing their jobs no matter the situation.
The great part about elections officials, county clerks, we're very resilient. We're going to get our job done, and we're not going to live our lives in fear.
A handful of other states, including Washington, have also mulled greater protections for election workers this year. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Russian forces pummeled Kiev and other cities across Ukraine on Monday as representatives from both countries met for a fourth round of talks. Over the weekend, Russia intensified its air campaign since its ground invasion has progressed slower than many had expected. In the country's south, Russian strikes have sparked a humanitarian crisis, including in the port city of Mariupol. More than 2,500 residents of the city have been killed there since the start of the invasion. The first residents to evacuate the city made their way along a humanitarian corridor on Monday. Russian forces have been so far observing a ceasefire along the route. Previous attempts to create a path in and out of the city have failed, with fleeing civilians often coming under Russian fire. Evacuations from areas around Ukraine's capital of Kiev also continued on Monday. Russia has consistently denied targeting civilians, but residential areas have been fired on by Russian airstrikes, and hospitals, schools, and vital infrastructure have been destroyed. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators met today to discuss a ceasefire, the immediate withdrawal of Russian troops, and security guarantees. Previous rounds of negotiations have failed to make concrete progress. Three U.S. officials said Sunday that they have reason to believe that Russia asked China for military equipment and other support after the start of its invasion of Ukraine. China pushed back on these reports, saying the U.S. is spreading disinformation. That was today. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov also denied that Moscow had requested military aid from other countries. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will speak on Wednesday to members of the U.S. Congress as the war on his country intensifies. The speech will be live-streamed for the public. Seeking again today to boost morale in the country, Zelensky was outdoors encouraging people to work to help save the country's economy. Zelensky said in a video posted to Telegram that Ukraine, quote, will rebuild everything, restore everything. More than 2 million people have fled Ukraine, while countless others have been displaced inside the country since the start of the invasion. The new Stress in America poll, conducted this March by the American Psychological Association, shows anxiety is soaring across the country, with the combination of inflation, the lengthy pandemic, and now concerns about a possible nuclear war with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Americans are admitting they're more stressed than ever. Ross Brown has more on the story.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has pushed American stress levels higher than ever before, according to a new poll by the American Psychological Association. In recent years, most U.S. residents cited the pandemic, money, work, and the economy as top stressors. Now, they say scenes of the Ukraine invasion by Russia have pushed their stress levels even higher. APA clinical psychologist Lynn Bufka says the organization conducted a February poll in anticipation of the two-year pandemic anniversary and then polled people again in early March, specifically about the war in Europe.
We found two-thirds or more are concerned about the economy, money, work. And then 80% or more of our respondents reported that they are very concerned about what's happening in Ukraine.
Bufka says the APA doesn't usually see such a large percentage of people citing this same stress factor. She adds the highest levels of stress previously reported in these surveys was during the 2008 recession. The March poll surveyed slightly more than 2,000 adults. Bufka notes the stress people report is a normal response to an abnormal situation. She adds that across the board, the possibility of nuclear war was especially concerning to those polled.
It's younger adults, older adults, people of color, men, women. The fact that we're seeing such a large proportion of the population also telling us that this is very stressful is different from even just 6 months ago.
In regard to the pandemic, Bufka says it's been especially difficult for parents because they're trying to manage their own concerns and also protect and raise their children.
The mental, emotional, internal resources one has for managing all the demands are stretched really thin for parents. It's been pretty overwhelming for parents in particular.
In addition to parents, Bufka says immigrants who fled a European conflict or veterans who have served in wars abroad say they are particularly stressed about the Ukraine conflict. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
The average price of regular gas in the U.S. has risen 79 cents over the past 2 weeks, reaching a record-setting $4.43 per gallon nationwide. That exceeds the previous record of $4.11 per gallon set in July 2008. It's 32 cents higher than that previous record. Compared to just 1 year ago, the price at the pump is $1.50 more. Nationwide, the highest average price for regular grade gas is in the San Francisco Bay Area at $5.79 a gallon. In Oregon, the average price is $4.74 a gallon. The average price of diesel also spiked, up over a dollar in the past 2 weeks, $5.20 a gallon for diesel. It currently costs $2.11 more than it did just 1 year ago. Experts have said gas prices are likely to remain high in the short term as crude oil costs soar due to the global supply concerns because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Prices at the pump were rising long before Russia invaded Ukraine as post-pandemic lockdown demand has pushed prices higher. Gas prices plummeted in early 2020 as economies around the world shut down because of COVID. At one point, the price of futures even turned negative, meaning some sellers were paying buyers to take their oil. Prices rebounded as demand recovered faster than producers pulled oil out of the ground, and so their inventories dried up. Energy prices are also contributing to the worst inflation that Americans have seen in 40 years, far outpacing higher wage trends. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for episode 13 of It Did Happen Here, a historical short-form documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together to run white supremacist street gangs out of Portland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, we'll hear Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 53. Today in history, in 1958, the Recording Industry Association of America awarded its first official gold record to Perry Como for his smash hit single, Catch a Falling Star. The next honoree was Lori London for He's Got the Whole World in His Hands, followed by Elvis Presley for Hard-Headed Woman. The quote of the day is from Nigerian novelist, poet, and critic Chinua Achebe. Achebe wrote in his book No Longer at Ease, quote, "The impatient idealist says, give me a place to stand and I shall move the earth. But such a place does not exist. We all have to stand on the earth itself and go with her at her pace." Pressure on Russian assets build even as missiles hit a training facility in western Ukraine. Trump held a rally in South Carolina, and Texas Democratic candidate Beto O'Rourke reverses his stance on critical race theory. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Moving assets out of Russian companies is being done because it's wrong to profit off of humanitarian horrors.
Grad student and climate activist Devon Reynolds wants the retirement fund for her and other Colorado public employees not to own Russian fossil fuel assets. Pressure for divestment is building here and in Europe. Sunday, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan restated that the U.S. will defend all NATO territory. A barrage of Russian missiles struck a training facility near Ukraine's border with NATO member Poland. At least 35 people died in the attack. The New York Times has confirmed that award-winning video journalist Brent Renaud was killed in Ukraine. He is the first American journalist known to be killed in the war. The Pentagon says it has not seen signs of an imminent chemical or biological attack, but experts say it's not out of the question. RAND Corporation researcher Daniel Gerenstein.
We're looking at the potential for a false flag operation. Something where the Russians may declare that there are issues and they're expecting some sort of chemical or biological attack, and they are going to prepare for that.
The White House has released an additional $200 million in defense assistance for Ukraine. At President Joe Biden's request, Congress has now approved billions more. South Carolina's Republican Party chair Drew McKissick lashed out at Democrats during a rally there over the weekend.
They've gone crazy. They're like that bar scene out of Star Wars, you know, a collection of everything that's crazy in the universe.
Former President Donald Trump called the rally to support House GOP candidates Katie Arrington and Russell Fry. In his speech, Trump blamed Biden for high gas prices and attacked his handling of Russia's invasion.
Under Biden, Pelosi, and the radical Democrats, we're losing our country no different than if we had lost it in a war.
In a possible preview of his campaign's position, Texas Democratic gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke publicly reversed his stance on critical race theory at a town hall meeting.
It's a course that is taught in law school. No, I don't think it should be taught in our schools.
O'Rourke's opponent, incumbent Governor Greg Abbott, signed a ban on critical race theory into law last summer. At the Democratic National Committee winter meeting in Washington, D.C., Vice President Kamala Harris said the party will have to work hard in the midterms to protect its majorities on Capitol Hill.
That's why you all are here, knowing the work that must be done, knowing it's not going to be easy.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Congress of American Indians is hosting a Violence Against Women Act tribal leader town hall. The federal government will fund relocation efforts for 6 Alaska communities threatened by erosion and flooding, and 20 trainees in Oregon will learn the traditional role of fire in managing the landscape. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians is hosting a Violence Against Women Act Tribal Leader Town Hall Wednesday. It follows last week's approval of the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization by Congress, included in a bipartisan appropriations deal. VAWA provisions help strengthen safety in Native communities, including a pilot program to allow some Alaska Native villages to exercise tribal jurisdiction over non-Indian offenders. ACIAC Chief Mike Williams Sr. says it's good for Alaska and all of Indian country.
We've been working so hard over the long years, especially here in Alaska, when we are dealing with 229 federally recognized tribes, and to empower each of the community is the goal to deal with these issues that are not good for our women and children, our elders in Alaska.
Tribal leaders will review provisions in the law and discuss next steps for tribal nations. The federal government will fund relocation efforts for 6 Alaska communities threatened by erosion and flooding. Most are in the YK Delta, where erosion and flooding are pervasive problems. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports the project will play out over time, and other threatened communities can still apply for funding.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced in early March that it will pay for Alaska communities to relocate buildings and infrastructure. The communities whose projects have already been funded include Kotlik, Alaganak, Kuigillingok, Gullivan, Tuntutuliak, and Tununik. What do they all have in common? They're threatened by erosion and flooding.
We are very excited.
That's Brett Nelson. He's a conservation engineer for USDA. His team has worked to provide flood and erosion mitigation around rural Alaska for years. He knows the communities and their needs. Nelson says this type of federal funding is a big deal. That's because it's a first. Usually, the federal government only funds his department to relocate buildings when there's an emergency, like when a home or building is about to fall into a river. But this funding will be preventative, so communities can begin their relocation efforts before it's too late.
Definitely. This is a new thing for up here.
Nelson says the entire process will take about 5 years. It involves multiple stages of planning before they can move into the actual construction and relocation part. But he says if any one building in those communities becomes urgently threatened, they can speed up the process for those structures. The application is still open for Alaska villages. Any village with an erosion, flooding, or permafrost issue is eligible to receive funding. In Juneau, I'm Olivia Eberts.
This week, outside Chiloquin, Oregon, 20 trainees will learn the traditional role of fire in managing the landscape. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The week-long training mirrors a similar program held outside Eugene last fall. Multiple agencies and Native American tribes from across Oregon are helping stage the burn, which will be on 2 acres of private land. Derek Kimball is a Klamath tribal member who participated in last year's training and is helping coordinate this week's program.
Our goals are to provide forest resiliency and to diminish wildfires so the forest is healthy and it won't catch into a big mega fire.
Before colonization, indigenous people did controlled burns to rejuvenate habitat and reduce fuel buildup. Kimball says he's heartened that after a century of fire suppression, non-tribal governments are becoming more open to what many Native people call cultural burns, patterned after the practices of their ancestors. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Mature trees in cities can provide cooling shade, soak up stormwater, and purify the air. Tony Giaruso at the Georgia Institute of Technology has been studying the city's trees for over a decade. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Mature trees store a lot of carbon, so they help reduce global warming. And they provide cooling shade, soak up stormwater, and help purify the air. So it's important for cities to know how many trees they have, where they are, and how they're changing. Tony Giarrusso at the Georgia Institute of Technology has been monitoring tree cover in Atlanta for more than a decade. He uses satellite imagery and mapping software to estimate the extent of the city's tree canopy.
You know, the branches and leaves and trees are seen from above, like out of a plane.
But he also dives deeper to see what's happening at the neighborhood level. For example, several years ago, tree cover in some low-income areas appeared to be expanding, but he found that much of the increase was caused by scrubby trees on vacant lots. Many of those trees were only temporary, because the lots would eventually be developed, and they did not provide the same benefits as big old hardwood trees.
So a lot of the gain that we saw, it was kind of false gain, or maybe the quality was not as good.
So he says getting a detailed picture of what's happening on the ground can determine how a city's trees are faring and the effects on people nearby. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
This week, Congress is expected to pass a massive bill to fund government agencies and avoid a shutdown, but the bill also forbids federal protection for the sage grouse, a bird species native to Northern California and much of the desert west. Suzanne Potter has more.
Conservation groups are slamming a spending deal in Congress that's expected to pass this week because it would forbid Endangered Species Act protections for an imperiled bird in the West. The sage grouse population in the high desert country of western states has dropped 80% since 1965. Yet federal spending bills have included this prohibition since 2014. This year, the initial bill dropped the ESA prohibition, but the final version restored it. Robert Dewey with the group Defenders of Wildlife calls it a huge missed opportunity.
Policy on the sage grouse must be driven by science and not politics. And I think it's time to end this prohibition and allow biologists to determine whether the species needs federal protection.
Sage grouse rely on sagebrush for food and shelter, and their habitat has dwindled with development and energy exploration. In 2015, the Obama administration negotiated a major compromise to protect the bird. A settlement between conservation groups, state agencies, the feds, ranchers, tribes, and the oil industry. However, the Trump administration opted to weaken that agreement. Dewey says this year, Republicans insisted on maintaining the requirement to keep the sage grouse from being classified as endangered.
Since 2015, 1.6 million acres of sage grouse habitat have been leased for oil and gas purposes. There's no doubt that the oil and gas industry is no fan of greater protections for the sage grouse.
Sage grouse habitat covers 11 states, from California east to the Dakotas. The same area supports more than 350 other declining species, including pronghorn, mule deer, pygmy rabbit, elk, and almost 200 species of birds. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, which features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Jonesy. Host Ken Jones presents part 2 of his interview with David Osman and Philip Proctor of the legendary comedy group The Firesign Theater and Firesign archivist Taylor Jessen. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus, which features interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means, hosted by Joseph Gallivan. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for It Did Happen Here.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
It's a piece of history, and I know a lot of people are talking about it, and I feel like I've just seen people write books on them, like they weren't even there, you know? I was definitely there. This is a part of my life, and I know there were some other people that this was really a lot for. I'm glad that I was a part of it, and I felt like we needed to do that. The struggle continues.
Welcome to Nothing is Final, Part 1, Episode 13 of It Did Happen Here. I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores. Last episode, you heard about the final years of the Coalition for Human Dignity. Now we'll hear from the punks.
We started with China. In the 80s, China was a black punk rocker, a fierce young street fighter, and anti-racist activist. China survived that and built a life for herself in defiance of the targeting she endured in her youth.
The city of Portland grew and changed as well. In 1990, the median home price in Portland was around $80,000. In the year 2000, it more than doubled to $166,000.
Now in 2021, it's at $500,000.
As an effect of this gentrification, by 2010, there were no majority black neighborhoods in the city. The former Industrial Northwest District, just north of downtown, transformed